Good morning. We have only one case today, and that's United States v. Castro. Appellant prepared to argue? Government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Appellant may argue.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Captain David Hamstra, along with my co-counsel, Major Christian DeLuke. We represent the appellant in this case, Sergeant Clovis Castro. Your Honor, may I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Granted. Thank you.
Under the facts of this case, appellant is convicted of a crime he could not commit, stealing fuel from the GSA. He could not commit this crime because the GSA neither owned nor had a greater possessory interest in this fuel. And no manipulation of Article 121, no last-minute argument for a new appellate standard of review can save this specification. Because as a matter of law, appellant could not have stolen this fuel from the GSA. And that's true, members of the panel, regardless of which Article 121 theory you consider. Although I think it's important to note that the military judge in this case only instructed on one theory, and that is wrongfully obtains, which incorporates the crime of larceny by false pretense. And the reason that these theories don't apply, members of the court, has to do with how credit cards work, in large part. When you use a credit card at a merchant, once the authorization for the card goes through, the merchant transfers title to those goods that you are buying with the card directly, so that the person who's using the card takes title to those goods. And that's exactly what happened in this case, members of the court. Appellant used the GSA fuel card. When the authorization went through, those third-party merchants, who were not the GSA, AFIS, BP, Amoco, whomever, those third-party merchants transferred title to that fuel directly to my client, such that my client was not pumping GSA-owned fuel into their gas tank, as the government contends.
Counsel, on that point, if he had driven up in a GSA vehicle and had purchased gas for a GSA vehicle and pumped it into his car, why then would the GSA own the gas in that situation?
If he pumped it into the GSA-owned vehicle, Your Honor?
Well, I mean, you just said that when he buys it with a credit card, he owns the gas. Why is it different if he pumps it into a GSA vehicle?
The difference there, Your Honor, would have to be if there was some sort of principal-agent relationship. There would have to be some way that the GSA would take a possessory interest in that fuel.
Now, in regard to the agency concept that you're putting forward, I note on page 17 of your brief, in the context of common law larceny, you say the government must establish that an agency relationship existed between appellant and the GSA at the time appellant bought the fuel. Then you say something similar on page 24. Because appellant was not the GSA's agent, it was impossible for appellant to steal the fuel from the GSA's possession. What is lacking is any cite to precedent, any cite to a treatise, even Black's Law Dictionary. Why is that, counsel?
The authority for that, Your Honor, which we agree we didn't cite in those two particular provisions that you cited, would be the precedent from this court on principal agency relationship, which is limited.
And what exactly? You're looking at Symbol, Sharp, and Williams, and so forth?
Correct, Your Honor.
But there's nothing here that you're citing. You're, in those contexts, you're drawing inference from it. Here you've stated what you put forward as black letter law, that there must be an agency relationship. There are thousands of larcenies that are going on in this country probably on a daily basis. One would think that that type of proposition would be able to be backed up by precedent. Maybe not in our military justice system, but at least in the civilian courts, and there's nothing there.
What I would say in response to that, Your Honor, is that based on these facts, you would need a principal-agency relationship. Perhaps I said that too broadly. Certainly, as you point out, there are many larcenies where you wouldn't need that. But in order for the GSA to take a greater possessory interest in this particular fuel, they would need some way to take a greater possessory interest than the title that my client took.
Well, that goes to the point that Judge Maggs is making. If you put the fuel into a GSA vehicle and immediately siphon it out, are you saying that they're is a different scenario there? The facts there are different enough where the manner in which your client was charged here would be permissible?
I believe it would be, Your Honor.
And what if instead of putting it into a GSA vehicle, what if it was a government-owned funnel Are you somehow saying that once you touch government property, there's the process of transubstantiation where it becomes government fuel?
What I would say to that, Your Honor, is that potentially an embezzlement theory could lie there. And because, as we point out in our initial brief, in order to embezzle something, a thief must first take it lawfully. So if he is taking the fuel to put it into the GSA vehicle, that is a lawful acquirement of the fuel that he would then embezzle. The problem here is that his acquiring of this fuel was not lawful. He was not allowed to use the GSA fuel card to pump fuel into his own vehicle.
Counsel, how was it not lawful? I mean, what part of this transaction was unlawful? Someone drove up to a gas station. They obtained fuel. They paid the merchant with what was appeared to be lawful form of payment. At that moment, when the fuel was purchased, what was unlawful about that transaction? Now, maybe the appellant exceeded his authority under the GSA, but that's not the law. That's not the merchant's problem. Like, what law was broken when the transaction occurred?
Well, Article 121, Your Honor. I mean, he did steal fuel. There's no doubt about it. The problem here is that the object of the larceny is incorrectly charged. So,
at what moment? You keep saying that the transaction was unlawful. I don't understand how the transaction itself in isolation. Now maybe he has an issue with the GSA, but how was the transaction itself unlawful? Like, he didn't pay with counterfeit money, right? He didn't come in and not pay at all. What part of the transaction itself with the merchant was unlawful?
Perhaps I'm using transaction too broadly. I think you're right. Actually using the card at the pump itself was not unlawful, as you point out. It wasn't a fake card. It wasn't that. But certainly it was unlawful when he put it in his vehicle. So maybe I was imprecise in describing that particular scenario.
Right, because as my colleagues have pointed out, if he had put that money in the GSA, the fuel in a GSA vehicle, there'd be no issue here, right?
Correct, Your Honor. I think a helpful case to draw that distinction is actually a case that the government cites, Your Honor, which is the case of Leslie. And there it's very obvious that the appellant's theft in that case, or embezzlement rather, first acquired the goods lawfully. So Leslie involved a sailor on a ship who worked in the mailroom, and his job was to receive the packages in the mail and to deliver them to the sailors. And there was a type of package called a COB package in which the recipient of the mail had to pay for that package. And so what Leslie did is he received the package, which was lawful and part of his job. He delivered the package, which was lawful and part of his job. And then he collected the money, which was lawful and part of his job, or the COB. At that point, he kept the money, which was, of course, unlawful embezzlement. Again, the difference here is when he takes that fuel and puts it in his car, it's unlawful, and the government hasn't shown how the GSA takes this greater possessory interest.
So suppose we were to write an opinion that said, with a guilty plea, there only has to be a substantial basis in law and fact. The military judge properly defined ownership, and your client admitted that he didn't own the gas and said that the GSA did, and therefore there's a substantial basis in law and fact for the conviction. What would be wrong with that opinion?
What would be wrong with that, Your Honor, is that my client, as you point out, did admit that he thought he was taking the fuel directly from the GSA, but his conclusory statements don't square with the law. As Professor Wayne Lefrave talks about in substantive criminal law, he discusses title and how title transfers, and he says whether title transfers depends on whether the person who has title intends it to transfer. And so the question here is, did these vendors intend to pass title directly to my client? I think clearly the answer is yes. We're talking about a consumable good that starts disappearing as soon as you drive away. I think a helpful counter to understand where you wouldn't pass title would be, suppose my client was renting a horse for a certain period of time. Now, clearly the owner of the horse there is not saying, you get title, you get ownership of this horse. He's merely giving custody.
On that hypothetical, the merchant obviously is parting. The merchant thinks that there's a sale. The merchant's parting title with the gasoline. The question is whether he's giving it, whether the GSA is acquiring title, or whether your client's is getting title, and the GSA paid for it. It's never objected. There's no evidence of any objection by the GSA, and your client has disclaimed ownership. Why isn't that a substantial basis? I mean, I think the merchant's irrelevant. The merchant is obviously giving up title. It's just really a dispute of whether it's the GSA or your client who owns it, and your client said, I didn't own it.
I don't think it's irrelevant, Your Honor, because as this Court has said in Williams most recently, what's important is not who suffers a loss, and clearly, as you point out, Your Honor, the GSA did suffer a loss. It's from whom did the client steal this goods? He didn't steal it from the GSA. He stole it from the merchants by using a false representation that he had authority to use this GSA fuel card as he did.
Well, the card, why isn't this symbol Sharpton written small? You know, symbol Sharpton had a general purchase card. She could buy all kinds of stuff for the government. She could buy furniture. She could buy, you know, and in fact, she did. This is a gas card. It's only good for gas. I don't know, maybe it's good for putting oil in or something like that. But basically, it's for gas. So he tenders the card. Here he pulls up to Exxon, and he tenders the card. You know, leave out the situation where you've got a GSA-owned gas station, which I guess there are some. He pulls up to Exxon. He sticks the card in. He tenders the card. The card is GSA's. The card is limited to official use of the purchased item. He sticks the card in. The gas gurgles into the tank. The gas gurgles into the tank to be paid for by GSA and to be used for official purposes. I'm not going to get into who's got title as opposed between Exxon and GSA, but GSA, wouldn't GSA have at the very least a superior interest to your client who is simply a thief?
My client is a thief, Your Honor. That much.
Well, yeah, we all agree he's a thief. okay, no, none of that, he's not a thief stuff.
Yes,
but anyway, when the gas gurgles into the tank, having been purchased with a GSA card, and therefore obligating GSA to pay for it, and under the terms of the card and the rental, the car agreement, to be limited to the for official business, why isn't that GSA's gas?
Well, Your Honor, I think initially you would ask, why isn't this like symbol Sharpton?
Well, I asked that, and, you know, it's a narrower universe, but basically he exceeded his authority because he wanted free gas. He got free gas. It gurgled into his tank, and off he went on a frolic of his own.
I think symbol Sharpton is important, as Your Honor points out, because there are some differences between symbol Sharpton in this case. That's
tell me what they are.
Yes, Your Honor. So symbol Sharpton was charged with stealing the money from the U.S. Air Force. Here, my client is charged with stealing the fuel of the GSA. The reason that's important, again, goes back to who is the object of the larceny. In symbol Sharpton, as this court explained in Williams, that conviction for symbol Sharpton was upheld under the Raggins dicta, a false pretense theory, the idea being that there was a contract between the Air Force and U.S. Bank, who was the card-issuing bank, such that anything that was purchased with this GPC, the Air Force was going to reimburse. So because symbol Sharpton bought goods, the Air Force had to pay money. And so the false representation theory in Raggins applied. Here, that doesn't work, Your Honor, because, again, the GSA...
He bought gas, false representation. He went putting off on a frolic of his own. Why isn't the same situation?
Because in symbol Sharpton, Your Honor, there was no question the Air Force owned that money. They owned that money before symbol Sharpton used the car, and they owned that
you
money.
You mean the money they used to pay the furniture store or whatever,
correct, Your Honor.
Or whatever it was?
The difference here is before my client drove up to this gas pump, the GSA didn't own the fuel that was in that gas pump. And the false representation here was...
Well, before symbol Sharpton walked into Home Depot and bought whatever it was she bought, the Air Force didn't own it either.
But she wasn't charged with stealing the goods, Your Honor. She was charged with taking the money from the Air Force, and they did own that money before symbol Sharpton walked up. That's the difference here. And the false representation, again, is that my client misled the merchants by telling them that he had the authority to use this card as he did. They were the ones who had the fuel. They were the ones from whom he took the fuel. Now, the government had a valid charging theory here, which was the initial charging theory that they used after consolidating those specifications. And that was that my client stole the money from the GSA. That would have mirrored Symbol-Sharpen exactly, Your Honor, and we wouldn't be here today. The problem is they decided to amend that specification the morning of trial, and they charged the wrong object of the larceny. And that's true, members of the court, even if we consider the other theories of larceny, such as embezzlement and taking. Embezzlement is particularly inapt here because, as we mentioned in our initial brief, in order to embezzle, courts as far back as the Supreme Court in the 1880s have held that you must first lawfully acquire the goods. That was a discussion we had earlier with Judge Hardy about how he did not lawfully acquire these goods, so the theory doesn't apply. The takings theory is also inapt because, for one, the government can't cite a single case. Taking incorporates the common law crime of larceny. The government can't cite a single case from the military courts, from the federal civilian courts, tribal, state, you name it, in which a credit card facilitated larceny was upheld under a common law larceny theory. And again,
are you trying to have it both ways? You seem to be arguing earlier that he did lawfully acquire these goods. The government screwed up this charge, and he in fact lawfully, as Judge Hardy's question, what was the matter with this transaction in the beginning? If, in fact, he lawfully acquired the gas, then why isn't it embezzlement going back to the statute of George III?
Well, Your Honor, let me clarify if I may have misspoke there. Again, when I'm talking about the transaction, I'm talking about it writ large, not just the use of the
card.
You're
talking about what?
I'm talking about the transaction writ large, Your Honor, not just the use of the card, but the putting the fuel into his vehicle. Clearly, the putting the fuel into his vehicle was not lawful. That's what I'm referring to there.
Okay, because it seemed to me like you had said the opposite.
No, I would say the use of the card, as Judge Hardy points out, the actual swiping it in the machine, that was lawful, right? It wasn't a fake card. He wasn't using some sort of cryptocurrency or something like that. That was lawful. But as soon as he puts that into his car, that's unlawful. Exceeds what the GSA fuel card is used. The problem with taking, as I was mentioning, is that historically, in order for a taking to take place, a common law larceny, you would have to take possession from the person that had possession initially, trespasser without permission, rather. But here again, the way these credit cards function, the merchant willingly gave up title to those goods because of the authorization going through. So the takings theory doesn't apply. In fact, the very article that the government cites in its brief by Major Owens Felice, which this court has cited as persuasive authority in Williams, flat out says that a takings theory is not relevant when considering a credit card facilitated larceny.
Thank you, counsel.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Chief Judge. And I'm sorry I'm asking this question at the end of your time. I hope you won't be docked the time for your rebuttal. But my question is this. One would think that in a guilty plea, as long as the accused admits to taking property from another who has a greater interest than he does, that that would be enough for a guilty plea. But in Williams, I think, and I want you to correct me here, or at least counsel me, maybe I should say that. And Williams was a guilty plea, but we said there that it wasn't enough. Did we not? Do you remember in Williams? Your memory should be better than mine.
Your Honor, I see I'm over time.
Go ahead. Please answer the question.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, Williams, as I recall, Your Honor, discussed Symbol-Sharpen in some other cases. I think you're asking about what were the actual facts related to Williams. Is that correct?
Well, I'm asking... We concluded, I thought, in Williams, and I'm kind of shooting from my hip or some other part of my anatomy, possibly, but I thought we said in Williams that you just admitting to having taken the property from someone who had a greater interest than the accused is not enough, that the substantial basis in law and fact would require that you admit to the specific target of the larceny.
I believe that's right, Your Honor. I'll admit I'm not remember that particular passage either, but certainly...
Well, I'm not quoting.
Sure, Your Honor. But certainly what this court said is What is important in charging larceny is from whom did you take this particular object of the larceny, the larceny good. Yeah. And that's the problem here, we contend, is that the government ended up charging the wrong object of the larceny.
I guess when I'm raising something that is beyond your purview, which is, it seems to me that if in a guilty plea, someone should simply be able to admit that he or she took the property from someone who had a greater interest than they did, which would make it somewhat irrelevant, I suppose, as who the target was. You obviously would not agree with me on that, but
may I continue to answer, Your Honor?
I am done, though. I was stating a colloquy there. I didn't really. It was a rhetorical question.
Would you mind if I answer, Your Honor?
Please do, sir.
If that's all right.
Answer.
Okay. I think the problem that we're talking about, Your Honor, is one of factual impossibility. That here, based on the facts as presented in the stipulation of fact and the provenance inquiry, it was not possible for the GSA to own this fuel because of the title discussion that we've had, and the government hasn't shown how the GSA somehow magically took a greater possessory interest in this fuel that my client took title to.
Yeah, I understand.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Yes, Your Honor. Chief Judge Stuckey, judges of the court, may it please the court, I am Captain Anthony Contrada, and along with Major Brett Kramer, I represent the government.
Could you speak up a little?
Yes, Your Honor, I apologize.
Thank you.
This court should affirm the Army Court for two reasons. First, the larceny specification alleged the correct owner, GSA, and appellant waived the opportunity to contest that factual issue when he pled guilty. Second, even if there was error, there was no material prejudice to appellant's substantial rights. And lastly, even if this court did set aside appellant's conviction for larceny, this court should affirm a finding of guilty to the lesser included offense of attempted larceny. Now, GSA was the proper entity to allege in the specification. The fuel was the property of the GSA because GSA was required to pay for the fuel and did pay for the fuel.
Counsel, on that point, I'm sorry to interrupt you so early, but since we're there, so you state the same thing in your brief, right? It says, importantly, in this case, the GSA had an arrangement to reimburse the merchants directly and was required to pay the cost of the fuel purchased with the card, right, which would put it in line with our earlier precedent. But and you cite JA 32 and 76, and the only thing I can find in the joint appendix to support that statement is where it says the accused admits that purchase of the fuel with the GSA fuel card required GSA to pay the cost of the fuel of the vendor. Is that the line in the JA that you're referring to that proves that there was a contractual relationship between the fuel merchants and GSA that required them to pay for all fuel purchase, even if it was fraudulent?
Yes, Your Honor. Joint Appendix 76 is the primary citation for that, that this was part of a card program that required GSA to pay all charges regardless of whether they were authorized or not authorized.
But there's no that what you just said, that fact, that's not represented anywhere in the record. I believe you, but if I wanted to go in the record and find proof of that program, it's not in here, is it?
So it's in the stipulation, Your Honor, also at Joint Appendix 33, the closely related point, appellant specifically admitted that GSA owned the fuel when he finished the transactions. Now, outside the joint appendix, there is also in the Allied papers, the GSA has their report of investigation, and that has largely the same facts identified in the first paragraph. Now, the government recognizes that was not part of the stipulation of facts specifically, but if you look at the language, it looks like that is probably one of the bases for that fact.
And then on this point, one other question. On page 74 of the Joint Appendix, it says, although the GSA viewed the transactions at issue in this case as unauthorized, the GSA made full payment to all of the merchants. That suggests to me that they have some discretion about whether or not they pay the merchants, which would seem to be inconsistent with the fact that they are contractually obligated to do so. Do you have any clarification of what that line means?
Not a clarification or expansion, Your Honor, but that is the way the government reads it as well, that although perhaps less that they had discretion and more that they had chosen to come to this arrangement with merchant gas stations. And there is another point, I don't have the site, but it is in the joint appendix in the Providency inquiry where appellant states that the GSA made payment directly to the gas stations, directly to the vendors, but I don't have another citation on that exact point, Your Honor.
But it is definitely the government's position that GSA bore all of the risk for fraudulent, for all transactions made with the cards, regardless of whether they were fraudulent or unauthorized.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and that's really one of the key facts that appellant stipulated to, is that any use of the card required GSA to pay the vendors. And under rule for court martial 910J in the United States versus Faircloth, by pleading guilty, appellant waived any objection regarding the factual issue of the owner of the property. And as we just went through, there are a number of very clear statements as to appellant's belief that the GSA owned this fuel. Now, we just heard appellant's counsel talk about Symbol Sharpton. What appellant doesn't reference in their brief or in their argument is that United States versus Williams counseled that the better charging theory in Symbol Sharpton would have been to charge theft of goods from the government rather than theft of money. And that's what the parties did here when they amended the charge and drafted the plea agreement. Because GSA was required to pay for the fuel that appellant stole, the military judge did not abuse his discretion when he accepted appellant's guilty plea. Moving on to prejudice.
But counsel, on that last point, part of appellant's argument is that the Providence inquiry was insufficient, that although he said that he owned the gas, there was no development of the basis for that belief during the Providence inquiry. What is your response to appellant's argument that the Providence inquiry is insufficient in this case?
So you won't be surprised to hear, Your Honor, the government disagrees with that, mainly because this is a simple commercial transaction where a card is used at a gas pump to acquire gas. So beyond the really key detail there is that the requirement of GSA to pay for the gas. Beyond that, appellants admitting that GSA owns something that they paid for is sufficient for a guilty plea such as this in the government's position. Does that answer Your Honor's question?
Thank you.
Moving on to prejudice, even if there was error in this case.
Before we move on to prejudice, can I ask you, counsel? We see a number of petitions, of course, that involve larceny. Sometimes it seems a little bit like whack-a-mole in terms of from whom the object was stolen and whether it should be cash or the items and so forth. We thought we had cleared this up in terms of Williams, Symbol Sharpton, and so forth. Apparently we haven't. What is the government's position in terms of what can we say in this opinion, in this case, that will clarify for the field how to charge these cases?
Well, the case law is clear that possessory interest is what matters. I think that this case is an easier case because this is a tangible item. It's not money. I think the confusion may stem from ownership of money in accounts, that's kind of the history of the confusion in this area of the case law. The government would say in the context of guilty pleas, along the lines of what we heard at the end of appellant's argument, that the idea that in a guilty plea, at least, as long as it's clear in the record that an appellant pled guilty and clearly understood he took something he did not own himself, that is sufficient. Now, in a contested case, I think that the movement of money in the accounts in Williams and Simpson, and particularly Simpson, that the finding as a matter of law without a developed record is tricky territory. But again, that's not this case. This is theft of a tangible good and not theft of money. And that's why the government believes this is under the rubric of Faircloth, and that all the court needs to find here in a guilty plea is that it's possible that GSA could have owned the gas, and that appellant admitted specifically that GSA owned the gas as a matter of fact. Now, moving on to prejudice, along the lines of what I just said, because appellant understood his his possessory interest was zero. In this case, even if the wrong owner was alleged, that error was harmless. There's no notice issues. He knew exactly the property he was pleading guilty to stealing. No double jeopardy concerns. An appellant was not wedded to a particular theory of larceny here when he pled guilty. Rather, he just wanted the benefit of his plea deal. And we see this very clearly because the word money was substituted for the word fuel. And finding prejudice, even if there was error in this case, would merely encourage gamesmanship and invited error in future larceny guilty pleas. Pending any further questions?
Captain Contrada, going back to, just for a minute, to Judge Hardy's point about the contractual relationship, if any, that GSA had, or the contractual obligation, I should say, to pay the vendors or the merchants. If we assume that's the case, if we assume that there's enough in the plea record, the plea inquiry, including the stipulation, does that put the case squarely at the situation with Semple Sharpton?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor. The key fact in both, following this court's opinion in Williams regarding Semple Sharpton, is the requirement of the government to pay the card regardless of whether it was an authorized purchase or not, and that's where the possessory interest comes from for the government in both Semple Sharpton and this case.
Thank you.
Counsel, before you finish, what exactly is the standard to create the agency relationship here between appellant and the GSA? Was it just the fact that he walked in and picked up the card? So does any service member who picks up a GSA card and then walks off with it, is that sufficient to create the necessary agency relationship?
Probably not that broad of a standard, Your Honor. However, here, appellant was, first of all, a government employee using a government card, and this was a card that he was specifically authorized to use in accordance with his duties. Certainly, he did not do so in this case, but the fact that he was an authorized user, was trained, was even authorized to assign this card out to other soldiers, that is sufficient, more than sufficient, to show an agency relationship for the purposes of the GSA card and the GSA. Pending any further questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. The government asked this court to affirm the Army Corps. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal.
Yes, sir. Just a few points, Your Honor. First, to your point, Judge Olson, how to clarify the law so that we're not here yet again with another credit card facilitated larceny a year from now. I think the answer to that is to overrule the Williams dicta, which is wrong. And let me explain why I believe that dicta is wrong. What the dicta is talking about, of course, is Semple Sharpton. But Semple Sharpton was not upheld under the Williams dicta theory. It was upheld under a wrongfully obtained or larceny by false pretense theory. What the Williams dicta is discussing is actually the better way to do it was embezzlement. And for the reasons I discussed earlier, that's wrong. Semple Sharpton, by buying goods that she was not authorized to buy, if you look at Semple Sharpton, it says the GPC was to be used only for medical supplies, and she was buying non-medical supply goods. Ergo, her actions were unlawful, and therefore an embezzlement theory wouldn't lie. So I think by overruling that dicta, which we didn't necessarily need anyway because the case was upheld under a larceny by false pretense or wrongfully obtained theory, that will help clarify that confusion. Because, again, if this case had been charged as it was initially when all of the specifications were consolidated, that my client stole money from the GSA, well, then, as Chief Judge Stuckey talks about, we are exactly in the Semple Sharpton arena. But the problem is by switching money to goods, the GSA didn't take ownership of those goods because of the title concern, and the government still hasn't shown how they took a greater possessory interest. That leads me to my second point. They talk about, well, there was a contract or an arrangement, and I agree with Judge Hardy, it's a little unclear from the record what exactly is there. But let's suppose for argument that there was some sort of arrangement for them to repay and that repaid. Again, just the fact that they suffered a loss because my client stole this fuel doesn't mean that they took a greater possessory interest in that same fuel. The reason why that contract and the repayment were relevant in Semple Sharpton is because Simple Sharpton was charged with taking the money from the Air Force. So, of course, we need to see, okay, well, how did the Air Force have that money and how did they give it up? But here, again, the GSA never owned this fuel, never had a greater possessory interest in that fuel. And one other quick point I'd like to note is that the government mentions the Allied papers. Well, of course, those are not part of the record under RCM 1112. I'd ask the court not to consider them. The other point I'd like to raise is this discussion of waiver and the idea that this issue was waived. This issue could not be raised, Your Honor, because as we point out in our reply brief, what we're arguing here is that this guilty plea was not intelligently made, that as the Supreme Court discussed in the 1998 case of Bosley and the Eighth Circuit applied in Ochoa, both of which are cited in our reply brief, that the issue here is when no one in that courtroom, including the military judge, understands the essential elements of the crime, that guilty plea cannot be found to be intelligently made. It is not a constitutional guilty plea under the Due Process Clause. And as this Court has regularly upheld, although unconditional guilty pleas generally waive all issues that are not jurisdictional or rooted in due process, this is very much an issue rooted in due process, and therefore it is not waived. The other thing I'd like to touch on is this principal-agent relationship issue. I believe the Court should look to its case law and should look to its restatement. Your Honor, I say I'm almost out of time. May I finish my thought here?
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I believe this Court should apply the restatement in deciding whether there is a common law principal agency relationship, as every other federal court does, including the U.S. Supreme Court. We cite numerous citations of that in our initial brief. And that also makes sense when you look at the case law, right? Under the restatement, the question of agency is one of, does the principal have the requisite control over the agent, and does the agent assent to that control? And here, the answer is no, right? You have the GSA, who's a lessor in a leasing relationship with the Army, who's the lessee. So how in the world does an employee of the lessee suddenly become an agent of the lessor? The government hasn't shown that. And a helpful way to think about that is to look at Symbol Sharpton, right, which this Court did describe as being an agency relationship. And the reason that makes sense is there the question was Symbol Sharpton an employee of the Air Force an agent? And quite often an employer-employee relationship will be a principal-agent one because an employer will have that requisite control over its employee, especially in the military, right, where the military can tell us what to wear, where to go, what to do for work, whether we deploy. There's a tremendous amount of control. The GSA simply did not have that control over an employee of the lessee. Thank you, members of the Court.
Thank you, counsel. Court is, case is now submitted. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Court is in recess pending further order of the court.